if we knew what exactly to expect throughout the solar system, we would have no reason to explore it. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Our opening quote was from Paul Anderson's The Saturn Game from 1981. Our solar system is still, of course, full of mysteries, and our exploration of it is in many ways still in its infancy. One of the biggest questions we strive to answer is where in our solar system, aside from Earth, might we find life? It turns out that there are several places we will want to explore, some that might surprise you, and many of those places are exceedingly hard to get to. To tell us a little bit about searching for life in the solar system, our guest today is Dr. Chris McKay from NASA Ames Research Center, who studies the prospects of life in the universe, a topic called astrobiology. He has been involved in many missions to several other solar system bodies, missions including the Huygens probe, Mars Phoenix Lander, and Mars Science Laboratory, which is known as the Curiosity rover. Getting to space is always a challenge, and getting to other worlds is far harder than that. Performing sensitive, cutting-edge science on another world, then, must be seen as one of humanity's greatest achievements. And remember, we can't know what we will find until we find it. Enjoy the interview by Parshadi Patel.
So thank you very much for talking to us today. And I know you are astrobiologist by profession, mm-hmm. and it is very a new field. It's not like astronomy or geology has been around for long. So would you mind start off by telling how you got into this field?
Well, I was interested in science. I got interested in astronomy by looking through a telescope, seeing amazing things. And about that same time, NASA started landing on Mars and sending back data about Mars and comparing it to Earth and the apparent absence of life on Mars and yet all the elements needed for life present on Mars. And this whole paradox of how could there be a world with all the elements needed for life but no life? And why did Earth have life in the first place? And so I got very interested in this planetary perspective of life. So I discovered life not by seeing it on Earth, but by puzzling about its absence on Mars.
Okay, that is very interesting. And I think nowadays everyone is attracted to astrobiology feature of astronomy. I know you have worked and you are working on many missions, including, you know, Huygens probe, MSL, Phoenix. So maybe you could describe a bit on what each mission has been.
And I'm involved in many NASA missions, but what they all have in common is that they are going to places that can tell us some part of the story about planets and life. So the worlds that I'm interested in are Mars, Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, Enceladus, a small moon of Saturn, and Titan, the large moon of Saturn. These four objects in particular are of interest to me because I think they have something to tell us about water, about organic material, and about the conditions that might be required for life. So any mission to any of those objects, I'm there. I'm on board. And so it's exciting that NASA and other space agencies are focusing on missions to these worlds. And there is also Canadian Space Agency involvement. The last two missions that I've been involved in to Mars, MSL and Phoenix, both had Canadian instruments as well. Everyone's excited about what we now call astrobiology, and I'm glad, I'm happy. I've been excited about it for a long time, so it's great to see this focus of attention there.
So MSL, as you mentioned, it's like right now up there in news. So would you describe a bit of what we are actually looking? So from the astrobiology point of view, what is MSL doing to look for life or the hints for life, as we say?
MSL will not search directly for life, but what it will do is search for organic material. And this is a big puzzle on Mars, because the Viking results seem to indicate that there was no organic material on Mars. And that would be an unfortunate fact in terms of the search for life. But then the Phoenix results seem to give us a new perspective on the Viking results, which argued that what Vikings saw was not a lack of organics, but a reaction of the organics in the instrument with a natural compound in the soil called perchlorate. So we had a new perspective on the Viking results, suggesting, yes, maybe there are organics in the soil. So MSL will have an organic detector. I'm a COI on that instrument. So for me, the most interesting thing that this rover will do is follow up on the Viking Phoenix perspective to see if there indeed there's perchlorate, and if we can see around the perchlorate to detect the natural organics. Once we've done that, the next step will be to see if we can then detect biological organics.
Okay, so how exactly does MSL do this, you know, finding organics?
Right. So far, the way we've tried to find organics, which we've done on one sample, we scooped up some sand and we analyzed it several times, but only on one sample from one site. What we've done so far is heat up the sample gradually from starting temperature to 800 degrees centigrade. And as we heat it up, compounds come out and we analyze them with a mass spectrometer. So that's the fundamental measurement tool we've had so far. And from that already, we've determined that, yes, there are perchlorates. We've seen them. Check. That's very satisfying because it confirms our interpretation of the Viking results. It's unfortunate because those perchlorates destroy organics, so it makes it hard to detect organics. So that's the next challenge we face, is getting around what I call this perchlorate wall, this reactive chemistry that is triggered by the perchlorates decomposing at about 350 degrees centigrade. And so if we can figure out how to get around that, we might be able to detect Martian organics. But that's for the next step as we operate on Mars.
So in your talk today, I also saw that you use lasers to shoot at different rocks on Mars to understand the chemistry they have and the compounds they have. So would you mind explain a little bit about what actually it does?
There's a new instrument on MSL that's never been on a lander or a rover before, which is a non-contact analyzer. And the way this instrument works is it shoots a very short but very intense beam of laser light at a soil or a rock, up to 7 meters away. And this intense beam of laser light creates a little tiny spark, a little tiny plasma. It's so hot, it creates a little tiny plasma, 20,000 degrees Kelvin. And as that plasma glows, we look at it with a spectrometer, and we look at the emission lines and try to characterize the elements in the plasma, which, of course, are elements in the rock that we zap. So we're going around zapping rocks and soil, measuring the elements that are glowing in the little plasma we create. The wonderful thing about this instrument is we can operate it without moving. The rover can just sit there, point the instrument, zap, 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 and we can do many, many rocks in a day. We can do rasters, up and down, square patterns. We can repeatedly zap one rock and look at the composition as we get deeper and deeper, literally burn a hole into the rock. We have shot that laser more than 10,000 times. It is very easy to do. We're using it more often, more frequently than any other scientific tool on the rover.
Does MSL plan to do this, or all its life on Mars, doing it while it's climbing the mountain, Mount Sharp?
We will zap rocks all the time. One of the nice things about this instrument is it doesn't have anything, any expendables. We don't run out of anything. We can zap rocks as long as we want, as often as we want. And that's why this instrument was included, was because it is such an easy instrument to operate.
Let me switch gears and talk about what more can we expect in terms of, you know, MSL finding. What other kind of things are we looking in terms of future for MSL and trying to find life, not only on Mars, but other planets as well?
MSL, I think, will continue to sample. What I hope is, now that we've identified perchlorate, our next milestone is to work around the perchlorate and identify the background organics on Mars. These are organics that would be in the soil everywhere. We think we saw them in the Viking results once we understood about the perchlorate. And they would be primarily due to meteorites. They aren't really relevant to biology at all, but they're organics. And by analyzing them, we will develop our techniques We will learn how to see around the perchlorate, and we'll understand the background organic signal on Mars. That will put us in a good position for the next step in the organics, which is to go into the clay deposits, which are up the mountain a little bit, and look to see if there's any organics in those clays. There, we might find organics that are different from these generic meteoritic organics, and that would be very interesting because the clays, we think, were deposited in water. And so if there is biology, it would be associated with the water. So maybe the clays are preserving organic remains of something that was living in the water, which would be very different than the organics that are falling into Mars now from the meteorite. So step by step, the story may get more interesting. First the perchlorates, then the meteoritic organics that are in the dust on Mars, and then maybe more interesting organics that may be contained in the clays that we will get to in a few weeks or a few months.
Okay, that brings me to the topic of human exploration on Mars. What does MSL help us to understand that would be, you know, useful for us to plan future missions? I know you are involved in planning human exploration. What kind of atmosphere do you plan to explore in terms of sending humans?
MSL contributes to human exploration indirectly in that the analyses we're doing of the soil and the search for life and the search for organic matter will help frame the kind of questions that humans will address when they go there. And, for example, in the case of the perchlorate, it's important to know if the perchlorate is everywhere on Mars and what its concentration is, because perchlorate is dangerous for humans. It interferes with thyroid function. And so if there is perchlorate everywhere on Mars, knowing that in advance will affect how we design a human mission. So some of the results from MSL and other missions are going to be very important in figuring out how we should build a base for humans.
I know you're heavily involved in terraforming Mars topic. So what ideas, now that we know so much from MSL and other orbiters and landers, what kind of terraforming are we planning, if we are planning one?
Well, right now, terraforming is still a thought experiment. But there's an important connection between terraforming and MSL. In order to make Mars habitable, fundamentally it needs a source of water. We think it's there. A source of carbon dioxide. We think it's there. And a source of nitrogen in the atmosphere. That's where we're not sure at all. And that may be the weakest link in the argument for terraforming Mars, is the question of adequate supplies of nitrogen. So one of the things we're doing with SAM that I'm particularly involved in fact, I'm the primary advocate for, is searching for nitrogen in the soil. We expect there to be nitrates in the soil. They're very hard to detect with any of the instruments we've sent to Mars on previous missions. SAM may be able to see the nitrates. So we are working in the data right now to try to find the nitrates. Unfortunately, the perchlorate, which makes the detection of organics difficult, also makes the detection of nitrates difficult. But we think we've got some leads, and maybe pretty soon we'll be able to report on the presence of nitrate in the soil, which would be a very important discovery in the context of terraforming.
So you have also worked on probes that try to understand the atmospheres of Mars and Titan and other planetary bodies. Would you mind explaining a little bit of how understanding these atmospheres would help us on, you know, trying to find life?
Well, beyond Mars, there's other worlds that are interesting in the search for life. Europa and Enceladus are interesting because these are icy worlds. And we believe that below the ice, there's oceans, both on Europa, a global ocean, a huge ocean, but deep below the ice, and on Enceladus, a small lake, if you will, below the ice. But there, the water is actually coming out, flowing into space, so it's very easy to sample, to access. But these are worlds with water, and water being the key requirement for life makes these worlds very interesting. On Enceladus, we also know that the water has organic material and biological nitrogen. And there's an energy source driving the plume. So Enceladus is special in my view in that it has all the main requirements for habitability. Energy, liquid water, carbon, organics, and biologically available nitrogen. Very cool. The big question about Enceladus is how long has it been habitable? What's the time frame? Millions of years? Billions of years? We're not sure. Titan is another interesting world, and I'm involved in missions to Titan and plans for future missions. There, not because it has water, but because it's the only other world besides Earth that has a liquid on its surface The liquid's not water. The liquid is liquid methane and liquid ethane. But it has liquid. It's the only other world in the solar system that right now has a beach. So you can go to the beach on Titan. You can go to the beach on Earth. But there's nowhere else you can go to the beach. On Europa and Enceladus, you have to go scuba diving. No beach. So, well, that's interesting because water obviously can support life. Maybe these other liquids can support life, too. Maybe the requirement for life is not so much water, but a liquid. If that's the case, then we have reason to be optimistic that maybe life could have evolved on Titan. And if we find life on Titan, that would be wonderfully strange because it's obviously very different from life on Earth, and it would tell us that life can take many different shapes and many different forms. It'd be very, to me, very exciting to find life in liquid methane on Titan. That's the best possible outcome of our search for life in our solar system.
So as you mentioned that there are future missions to these kind of planetary bodies, would you mind shedding a little bit of light on those missions?
Right now, we have the big rover on Mars. We have two more Mars missions planned. One is an orbiter called MAVEN, which will study the upper atmosphere of Mars, and the other is a lander called InSight, which will land on Mars and measure heat flow on the surface. So these are focused missions, much smaller in size and cost than the rover. In the outer solar system, we are looking at missions. Nothing is finalized yet. There's discussions of a Europa orbiter. There's discussions of an Enceladus sample return. And there's discussions of a mission to Titan that could be a lander in one of the lakes or a balloon mission or an airplane mission. All of these are still in play. There's active work on studying them. None of the missions to the outer solar system have been selected yet. But what's interesting to me is that all the candidates for outer solar system mission focus on astrobiology as the objective. There's sort of been a convergence of realization that astrobiology is the interesting questions to ask in the outer solar system. I think that's very, very satisfying.
Yeah, on that note, I would like to ask you, I know that we, as alive, we only know life as on Earth. So when we look to these other planetary bodies, what we compare is to our own Earth. And I know you're involved in many missions studying, you know, habitats on Earth, which we think might be, you know, same, let's say, analog sites of these kind of bodies. So would you mind elaborating a little bit on that, on how you actually, you know, do comparing? Right.
Obviously, everything we know about life, we've learned on Earth. And here we have only one example of life. At the fundamental biochemical level, there's only one type of life here. So we have to be careful drawing conclusions about life when we only have one example. And part of the way we can try to generalize our understanding is to go to the limits of life on Earth, go to places in extreme environments where life is living on the edge of its capabilities. And so we've been doing a lot of that and building up an understanding of it. But even so, we have to be careful because we may go to Mars, or even more bizarre, Titan, and find life forms that are very different than what we have on Earth, and they may live in a very different way. We run the risk of not even recognizing. We go search for life, and it's right there. We don't see it because we're not prepared to see something that we're not expecting. So it's a constant concern, and we have to worry about it. On the other hand, we have to do specific missions. We don't have any way to do a mission that detects everything. We have to choose what we look for and how we detect it and what instrument we fly. So we always have to balance between doing something that's practical and feasible and focused on particular instruments and being aware that things might be different than what we think. So we'll just have to strike that balance and play it the best we can.
I also know that you define alien life as completely different than what we see life here. So would you mind elaborating a little bit on that?
In a sense, what I'm looking for is not just life on another world, but I'm looking for a second genesis of life on a second world. I'm looking to find proof that life started independent of life on Earth. Because one of the things we've learned in the last 20 years is that impacts can knock rocks off one planet and send them to another planet, and that exchange could carry life from one world to another. So there may be life on Mars that may have came from Earth, or it may be that life on Earth came from Mars via this impact exchange process. So when we find life, the first question I want to ask is that life different from Earth life? Does it represent the second genesis? And to ask that question or to answer that question, we need to study the biochemistry of the life and compare it to our biochemistry. We'd like to find life that's as different as possible.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. Hopefully you will get back sometime soon and have, you know, talk more about the MSL and what it's going to do in future months. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Chris McKay from NASA Ames, and we talked a lot about Mars and finding life on Mars. But I think the most interesting topic right now is terraforming Mars. So what are your thoughts about terraforming?
Well, it would be a big task. Some of the resources we would need are on Mars, and we would only need to unlock them. But even doing that would be enormously complicated, of course, to unlock all the carbon dioxide, all the water that we would need from Mars. Very challenging. And then there are a lot of elements that we're not sure are there, like the nitrogen. And then you have to wonder, how do we get the oxygen into the air if we need to breathe it? Is it even there? Is there enough? Or has a lot of it escaped? So we might have to be carting gases over there or something. That'd be a big task.
Yeah, one crazy plan involved redirecting comets to crash into it. Yeah. And then there you get some volatiles.
Well, we probably need to do something like that to break up the ice caps anyway, right? To heat them up and release some of that gas.
Maybe. I mean, they're already so volatile that, like, some huge fraction of the atmosphere is already moving from one end to the other and condensing out. So it's probably not that hard to evaporate those ice caps if you can bring the temperature up a bit.
Well, the ice stays put. The dry ice migrates back and forth.
The carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, warm up the atmosphere and that ice will start melting. We've already seen that on one planet.
Yeah. As humans, we can warm up an atmosphere. We know what we're doing.
Yeah. But the question, I guess, is, you know, as Dr. McKay points out, is there enough nitrogen around? And then, you know, if you look, speaking as an engineer, where do you get the energy to do this?
Drop some asteroids.
Well, you get energy to make big holes in the ground.
Right? Yeah.
But where do you, you know, how are you going to power this process? There's a whole lot of chemistry there. There's some sunlight to be had, but you're going to have to think about a lot of energy input to do these transformations. And then, if you make all that atmosphere, well, Mars has a very thin atmosphere now. How come? And is it going to keep that atmosphere if you make it? How long do you buy yourself?
Yeah, we probably need to set up a magnetosphere or something to protect the atmosphere as well. I mean,
have to make an artificial magnetosphere, oh boy, that's a challenge. I don't know if you have to do that, but if you do, boy, that's going to be
big task.
That's going to be a big task.
A lot of money too.
Yeah, we're not going to be running this process on fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. We need some other energy source for sure.
Well, I'll tell you, if you find fossil fuels to provide energy on Mars, you've already solved one of the big questions. But speaking of fossil fuels, there are lots of places where huge deposits of hydrocarbons are to be found in the solar system.
For example, Titan.
Aha!
If somehow we can have a shipping link across between Titan and Mars, we can definitely use a lot of fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you bring it to Mars, we might as well bring it to Earth where we can burn it, right? But that's going to be... That's not what I had in mind, was mining the hydrocarbon, but there's an idea, I guess. But of course, Dr. McKay suggested that might even be a place where you could have some kind of exotic life.
Yeah, of course, there's a question of, he mentioned extremophiles as a thing that can live on Earth in some really surprising places. So, but life probably arose in some of the easier places on Earth and then migrated to some of the more difficult places and survives because life is very capable. Mm-hmm. The real question is, can life arise in a weird place like Titan? Once, if we were to establish some there, I'm sure it would evolve and figure out a way to live, but could it arise there in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's cold and you got liquid methane and you have kind of like a hydrological cycle of rain, storms and things, and rivers and whatnot. But the chemistry is pretty weird.
Yeah, bringing to Dave's point, we might would have already contaminated it with the probe that landed on Titan.
With Huygens, so, yeah.
Yeah, Huygens. So we might would have already planted the seeds of life there. You never know. But if and how they evolve would be a good question.
Yeah, I mean, could Earth bacteria that presumably are on this probe. They seem to be on everything. Could Earth bacteria last in that very cold environment where there's not much to be said about water or sunlight or nutrients? I don't know.
Yeah, I think probably we'd have to engineer something specifically to survive there.
Yeah.
I don't know if the common cold would thrive, but then again, it thrives everywhere, so who knows?
Yeah, I wonder if it's worth it. I wonder if there's much point in, like, designing some microbe to live in that place.
Well, it might be a component of terraforming Mars, right? To establish some life and put out some oxygen.
Yep.
But on Titan, probably not. We're not terraforming that place anytime soon. It's way too cold.
It's pretty cold.
Way too far.
Yeah. Way too far.
So what are your thoughts about sending humans to Mars? Now, terraforming is probably a longer span mission, I would say, or like an idea.
It's going to take a long time even to start.
But that doesn't mean that we can't have bases there, that we can't have domes even or something where plenty of people could survive and thrive on Mars and do lots and lots of interesting things.
You know, one of the things I learned from Dr. McKay was the problem of perchlorates, these things that get in the way of science because they mess up our measurements for organic compounds. But apparently it's also toxic to humans. And if you're tracking that in on your boots into your space habitat, that makes EVAs a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think the MSL probably is going to help a lot. Or like the Fusion Mission, which is announced for 2020, is probably going to help us understand a lot before we actually send out humans to...
Yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done. We have to understand a lot more than we do now. We would have to do a lot of laying of groundwork before we can actually hope to send people there.
I think 50 to 100 years is a good time scale.
Oh, wow, geez. Not very optimistic, but...
I'm impatient. Let's try and get it done in the next decade or two.
Next decade or two. Well, you know, we're landing these heavy rovers now on the surface. Heavy, heavy things that not only make it to the surface, but also can drive around after and are working after. And that's important groundwork. That's the next layer of bricks. If you want to send humans, it's going to be even heavier than MSL.
I think if you want to send a human, I would think one country cannot do it alone. You need, like our previous show that we talk about, we need international collaboration. And maybe back then when the U.S. sent a person to the moon, and just imagine what we could do with modern technology if all the countries collaborate together. We can probably do it in 10 years.
Well, when we're speaking of how much money is required, yeah, we're probably going to need international cooperation. But then there's also the wonderful fact that if we were to send a team to Mars that was composed of people from many different countries, now how wonderful would that be? We wouldn't be planting one country's flag on Mars and saying this belongs to one country. Mm-hmm. We'd be saying this belongs to all the people of Earth. And that could be quite something.
Yeah, it's a very different statement from this kind of Cold War nationalism, planting flags, beating the opponents.
Yeah, back then the money came from trying to beat the Russians, right?
Yeah.
So now if the money could actually come from a positive, peaceful endeavor with many countries working together and all committing their funds and their efforts.
For the benefit of humans. Just like in Star Trek, are they like, they have their economy is just based on the benefit of human race, right?
But I think with the idea of taking too many different, you know, people from too many different cultures would be difficult as well, because A, communication problems. Astronauts need to learn Russian right now to go to space. But people from different cultures have different foods, different ways. Surviving the trip from here to Mars and back, if they are coming, would be difficult. I mean, you know, psychologically, it's not a fun thing to go out.
Even for one person on their own with no other problems, we're not too sure psychologically how they handle the trip.
But maybe the International Space Station could be a model for that, right? We've already got people from something like a dozen countries, Europe and North America and Russia, already working together. And, you know, they have Russian food and they have U.S. segment food and they have
Japanese sushi.
That's right. They have all of these things and they have to operate bilingually, talking to the Russian and to the other control centers that are working in English. And it's complicated and it's difficult and it's less efficient than it would be if it was all done by one group, but it's effective.
Yes.
And it's achievable. Yes. So maybe
it's necessary, right?
Yeah.
So it's not going to be able to be done by one country. But yeah, so the ISS is a good exemplar of what we're going to have to do. And it's one of those projects where it's laying the groundwork. You know, we don't just have to research what is Mars soil going to be like. We have to research what are people going to be like after traveling this great distance to Mars and then being stranded on an alien planet.
Stranded. Let's hope not.
Potentially stranded.
Yeah.
Intentionally.
Intentionally stranded, maybe.
Well, they, I guess so. NASA and Roscosmos recently announced a plan to use ISS for a demonstration of longer duration.
Yeah, one-year trip.
Yeah, the year-long thing. They're going to have two crew that will stay up there for a year or so, which is still not long enough to go to Mars, but twice as long as they usually do on the space station.
Well, there are projects that put people at the South Pole and isolate them as a replica of what it would be like to be, you know, isolated on Mars or on a trip to Mars.
Yeah, at least for the psychological aspects. That whole weightless biology thing is a real problem.
So recently NASA announced they found organic compounds, though they are not sure if they are, you know, authentic Martian organic compounds. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, you know, for starters, what I think is really interesting is that the field of astrobiology is fairly young, right? And we were once doing space exploration for the purpose of doing space exploration. But now a lot of missions, whether we're talking about Mars, Europa, Enceladus, Titan, all of these missions, they all have a bit of astrobiological bent, right? Where we're trying to identify organics, as was potentially done on Mars, and we're looking for the potential of life. And this was not what we were once doing, but it seems to be, you know, the unifying drive that we're developing for space travel. And I think that's a very good thing, right? It's not just about exploring, but it's about searching for something. And that provides people something to grasp onto. So when they announced the potential of those organic molecules, yeah, it's very interesting. It captivates people. And of course, they kind of made the announcement seem beforehand like it might be very, very big. And then they sort of had to draw back. And that was unfortunate. But it's an important step.
Sent the Viking missions to Mars back in the 70s. And we thought that Mars was a candidate for life. And Mars, Viking, I should say, seemed to show that Mars, no life. And inconclusive at best, probably nothing. And we didn't, we kind of knocked it off for And now we're starting, after sending some probes to the other planets and getting to know a bit the solar system better, we're starting to see a whole bunch of places where, oh, maybe, kind of, there's a possibility, there's an outside chance, and we don't really know how to characterize how outside those chances are. And so it's sort of, everything looks like it's a long shot, so maybe let's start to investigate all of these possibilities. We already know what all these bodies in the solar system look like, by and large. We've sent missions to go and take pictures of them. But if you want to understand them in more detail, you have to start looking at chemistry and the surface processes. And if there's life, it will be involved in both of those.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester, and featured an interview by co-host Parshadi Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Dave Kirsch, and Parshadi Patel. Our editor for this episode was Parshadi Patel, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here, on astronomy.fm.